Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Today, as we move into the month of October, coming soon in the year 2002, as many of our listeners know, if you've been listening to WILL for the past week, we've been airing the hearings in Congress on the prospective war in Iraq and the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the regime change in Iraq. This is one of the big stories, media stories and political stories of our times. There's a lot that's being covered in the news media, but perhaps there's a lot that isn't being covered. Today, we're very fortunate to have as our guest on Media Matters here in the studios at WILL, Francis Boyle, a law professor at the University of Illinois who's been here for about 20-some years. He teaches public international law, international human rights law, jurisprudence, as well as a seminar on the constitutional law of U.S. foreign affairs. Francis Boyle has written and lectured extensively in the United States and abroad on the relationship between international law and politics. He's the author of several highly regarded books, and it's really a pleasure to have you here with us today, Francis Boyle.
Bob, thank you for having me on, and my congratulations to you for having this show. It's a real breath of fresh air here in central Illinois.
Well, thanks a lot. Flattery will get everywhere. Do you want to be on every week from now on? By the way, what's your new book, just so we can get that out? You mentioned it before we went on air.
The new book is The Criminality of Nuclear Deterrence with a foreword by Phil Berrigan, and you can get it at Amazon.com for $15. It has a special introduction dealing with the terrible events of September 11th.
Great. Well, thank you for letting us know about that, The Criminality of Nuclear Deterrence.
Right.
Well, that's sort of what I want to talk about today, as if not nuclear deterrence, it might lead to that, but certainly the state of the world today of international law and of militarism around the world, and specifically wars of deterrence, preemptive strikes, everything we're hearing when we talk about the war on terrorism, and specifically now the prospective war in Iraq. And, you know, let's start with the fact that since the decline of the Soviet Union, the collapse of the Soviet Union, a little over a decade ago, the United States is engaged in a series of wars around the world, and they've been sort of put under the rubric of humanitarian wars. These are a new genre of war in which the motivation is simply to help countries that are where the domestic populations are suffering under tyranny. And the United States is coming in as the white knight to liberate these populations, be they in Kosovo or Serbia or Iraq in the earlier Gulf War or places in Africa. What is the – first of all, is that an accurate assessment of what's been taking place in the last decade in your view? And secondly, whatever the assessment is, what's the legal basis in terms of international law for countries engaging in humanitarian wars?
Right, Bob. It seems that the people who run the government try to come up with whatever pretext and justification is possible to justify a war that they have already decided upon for political, geostrategic, and economic reasons, especially Iraq, where it still is all about oil. The Clinton administration used this bogus doctrine of humanitarian intervention. I just wrote a whole article on the subject, humanitarian intervention under international law. It was published in London. This doctrine was rejected by the International Court of Justice overwhelmingly way back in 1986 in the Nicaragua case. So there's no basis in law for that.
But you're also arguing, if I interrupt, Francis, that even if you think it's a whole bogus concept to begin with, though, I mean, the whole idea.
It's completely bogus.
I mean, even if it wasn't bogus, it's been rejected by law as a legitimate thing.
That's correct.
So it's on two scores. It's
illegal and it's bogus.
Okay.
Indeed, as I point out in my article, in scholarly studies that have been undertaken on the invocation of this doctrine going back to the mid-19th century, I think maybe 70, 80 times or more, they found maybe one that might qualify. And even that was questionable.
Which one was that?
Well, it was some intervention in the Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
So that tells you how long that is. And that's even questionable. I've written about this in my own book, Foundations of World Order. All the U.S. military interventions in Central America were justified on humanitarian grounds. But when the documents were later published a generation later, all that was bogus. So,
I mean, two questions that come out when I hear this, and I'm sorry to keep interrupting, but I just want to get this out on the front. If someone posits this humanitarian intervention argument, the question then becomes, two questions jump out right away, I think. One is, why do you intervene in country A and not country B? I mean, what makes one country deserve humanitarian intervention against another one? And secondly, who gets to pick who does these humanitarian interventions? Why the United States? Why not Paraguay? Why not Peru? Why not Nigeria? Why aren't they all over the world?
Right. The record establishes, again, going back to the 19th century, that it's basically Western colonial imperial powers such as Britain, France, the United States, who have historically invoked this doctrine to justify military intervention on smaller states and smaller peoples for political, economic, geostrategic reasons that have absolutely nothing at all to do with humanitarian considerations. But again, legally, the doctrine was rejected by the International Court of Justice as recently as 1986. The Reagan administration was trying to justify its contra-terror war against Nicaragua on these grounds. I spent a week down in Nicaragua up in the war zone, Matagalpa. And, of course, this was total balderdash. The Contras were an anti-civilian force. They were killing women, children, old men. They would not attack the Nicaraguan soldiers. And eventually the World Court, considering the doctrine, rejected it and said it's not for the United States to evaluate the state of human rights in Nicaragua. And the United States has no right to use military force toward that end. So this doctrine has been soundly repudiated by the International Court of Justice, which is the highest legal authority in the world. And the only group of international law professors who, in theory, try to argue this doctrine are those who are on the payroll of the United States government or else advise and consult with different branches of the United States government.
And so they have a conflict of interest,
right,
in a very traditional sense of
right.
the term.
Now what we've seen with the Bush Jr. administration, of course, is a shift in rhetoric. They're using the humanitarian doctrine. Now what we're seeing is this doctrine, these doctrines of preemptive strike and regime change. As you know, Vice President Cheney made two speeches, first the Veterans of Foreign Wars and then the Korean War veterans, trying to articulate this doctrine of preemptive strike. Well, what is not being pointed out in the mainstream news media is that the doctrine of preemptive attack was soundly rejected by the Nuremberg Tribunal in 1946. When the lawyers for the Nazi defendants tried to argue preemptive attack to justify the Nazi invasion of Norway. And the Nuremberg Tribunal,
I guess
which—
in theory, that makes sense. I mean, Norway is definitely an expansionist threat.
Well—
My wife's Norwegian.
Right.
Fine.
So, and let us recall it, the whole Nuremberg experience was the idea of President Roosevelt.
Isn't Norway a dagger pointing at the heart of Europe? Isn't that
the well, you know, that's what the Nazi lawyers tried to argue. And the Nuremberg Tribunal, in which we had a judge, prosecutor, said quite clearly the necessity of self-defense must be instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice of means, no moment for deliberation. And what distresses me now as a law professor, 25 years, licensed attorney over 25 years, is that we have the Vice President of the United States of America trying to sell an argument that was basically a Nazi argument and was soundly rejected a generation ago at Nuremberg. So these are the dangers of this preemptive war doctrine that we're hearing about today. Congress is currently considering it. If you look at the draft resolution to wage war against Iraq, the Bush Jr. administration tried to incorporate the doctrine of preemptive war. If you look at the new White House war planning document that they just put out, it incorporates this doctrine of preemptive war, preemptive attack. It even uses the language, the best defense is a good offense. Now, I'm a litigator, have been a litigator at the International Court of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
I could take this official White House document, file it against the United States government as an admission against interest that we are now in the position of adopting a doctrine of offensive warfare. That's how serious this is. And it appears they are going to be applying this doctrine to justify this needless, illegal war against Iraq.
We're talking to Professor Francis Boyle of the University of Illinois Law School today in Media Matters. Today's show was pre-recorded just a couple of days before we went on air so we could get Professor Boyle in the studio here. And so don't call in today. Today, just sit back and put your feet up, enjoy the show, and let us do the talking. And Professor Boyle, let's backtrack for just a second. I want to get to Iraq again. And I want to talk about preemptive strikes, this notion, this very dubious notion in some length. But I'd like to put it in a little broader context again. Let's go through these humanitarian wars, then work into the war of terrorism for a second for the sake of our listeners. You know, starting, as I said, with going back to the 80s with this claim of humanitarian wars, but then especially during the Clinton era, when there were several of these humanitarian wars or bombings in different countries around the world, you're arguing and you're saying that these have no basis in legality, that the various interventions the U.S. did during the Clinton administration up to the war on terrorism were all illegal, basically?
And in fact, this Bush Jr. war on terrorism, the Reagan administration and Bush Sr. started out under then Secretary of State Haig, claiming that the United States government was going to shift its emphasis on human rights under President Carter to waging a war against international terrorism. And then they proceeded a whole series, invading Grenada, bombing Tripoli and Benghazi, bombing Druze villages in Lebanon, invading Panama. You have an entire decade of waging war against other states, other peoples in third world countries who are pretty powerless, arguing.
And these all violated international
terrorism.
Law? There was no...
Sure. Almost all of them. Professor Murphy did a book called Humanitarian Intervention and International Law. He wrote it when he was a lawyer for the State Department, looking at all of these interventions and concluding they were, for the most part, all illegal. Sean Murphy is his name. He's now a professor at GW Law School.
George Washington.
And then after his book went to press, as you know, the war allegedly for humanitarian purposes in Kosovo, Noam Chomsky's written an excellent book on that, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Okay.
So there is no basis in law, and I think whenever you hear any state, it's just not the United States, but a powerful military state saying you were using military force for humanitarian reasons, you know that's a contradiction in terms. You don't promote human rights by killing people. It doesn't work that way.
Well, now, I think a lot of our listeners are probably going to say, but wait a second, Professor Boyle. We've got these terrible regimes around the world, or we've got these terrorist groups around the world blowing up buildings, killing thousands of innocent civilians, maybe torturing their own domestic populations. depending on if you're talking about governments or if you're talking about private terrorist organizations. In international law, is it just sort of tying the hands of the victim so they can't act to do something against this? Is there recourse in international law, or does international law basically protect the perpetrators of these sort of criminal acts?
No, there are all sorts of mechanisms, procedures, and rules that can be adopted to deal with these problems, the problem of international terrorism. Indeed, I wrote another book on this, World Politics and International Law. The United Nations had concluded 12 different treaties dealing with different aspects of international terrorism, several of which were directly relevant to the attacks on September 11th. Originally, President Bush Jr. said this was an act of terrorism, but then all of a sudden the signals changed and he proceeded to call it an act of war.
That's a really good point, and you've made this before. And let's really frame this again because this is so important. Because I think most Americans, you know, terrorism is something they knew a little bit about during the 80s and 90s, but it wasn't a central issue. I mean, 9/11 really brought it into focus, obviously, for everyone. Suddenly, you've got the two biggest buildings in New York destroyed. You've got thousands of people murdered. And you argue that this wasn't an act of war, if I understand right, and we shouldn't have responded as if it was an act of war. Could you explain that to our listeners to understand what your legal basis and political or ethical argument might be as well?
Sure. Again, I address this at great length in my new book, The Criminality of Nuclear Deterrence. Will the U.S. war on terrorism go nuclear? Mm-hmm. Is the question, and that's a serious question right now. We're contemplating
Absolutely.
War against Iraq, and Bush Jr. has already ordered the Pentagon to draw up war plans for the first use of nuclear weapons against Iraq and in the Middle East. An act of terrorism has a definition under United States domestic law. Clearly, the attacks of September 11th, the World Trade Center, would qualify. There is no generally accepted international definition of terrorism for a variety of reasons not really relevant here. But the decision was made with the full participation of the United States government. Let's deal with the phenomena of international terrorism piecemeal. We don't like airplane hijacking. We'll deal with that. We don't like letter bombs. We'll deal with that. We don't like this, that, and the other thing. So there had evolved a series of 12 or 13 treaties to deal with the matter. And historically, that is the way we had dealt with them. For example, when there were the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Africa, we dealt with those bombings as a matter of domestic and international law enforcement. When the World Trade Center was hit, originally President Bush Jr. said this was an act of terrorism. And under United States domestic law, it qualified as such. And by the way, the Oklahoma Federal Building, the Murrah Federal Building bombing, we dealt with as an act of terrorism. Several hundred people were killed. And what I argued at the time, indeed I appeared, we're talking about the news media here, on September 13th, the O'Reilly Factor called and asked me to go on that evening to debate Bill O'Reilly in his blowhard zone, I like to call it, on war versus peace, O'Reilly favoring war and me favoring a peaceful, lawful resolution of this problem. For whatever reason, the Bush Jr. administration decided to abandon the rule of law to deal with this matter and just proceeded to call it an act of war.
And they did that almost immediately?
Almost very quickly.
Within a day or two?
Yes, very quickly. And
There was no debate on this in the news media or among Democrats and Republicans.
None.
This is just accepted as a fait accompli.
That is correct.
Okay.
And the...
Even though, as you're saying, it's get this real clear, that by all... known legal standards, it was an act of terrorism, not an act of war.
It clearly was an act of terrorism. It was not an act of war because for an act of war, as happened, say, at Pearl Harbor, you need an attack by one nation state against another nation state. Mm-hmm. And there is no evidence and still has not surfaced evidence that the government of Afghanistan at that time ordered or directed the terrorist bombings on September 11th.
And their crime was simply housing the people who did.
Well, they were there.
They were
right.
Yeah.
But no evidence that they had ordered or directed it. And indeed, FBI Director Mueller and a deputy director of the CIA have publicly stated as recently as this summer that they have so far found no evidence in Afghanistan tied directly into the September 11th bombings.
We're talking to Francis Boyle today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This show we taped a couple days before going on air, so don't try to call and say, just sit back, have a cup of tea, relax, and enjoy the show. Before we get back to the show, I just want to make a couple of announcements. If you'd like to receive a weekly update on what's going to be on Media Matters, you can do so by simply sending an email to us. And the email address you send it to is listproc@prairienet.org. And then in the message, just put subscribe, Media Matters, and then your name, you know, Jane Doe. And you'll get a weekly update. And for example, this week, if you'd been one of our subscribers, you would have gotten us a note at the end of the week alerting you that we'd changed a guest this week to Francis Boyle so we could have this discussion on the upcoming attack or war on Iraq. So you'd note that we made this last second change. And we will not use this list at any time for commercial purposes. You'll only get one message a week and we won't be distributing it. We'll also give you links in these emails so you can find more out about our guests, their books, what they're doing, the organizations they work with. So listproc@prairienet.org. And then in the message, just put subscribe, Media Matters, in your name and get on our mailing list. And I think you'll be glad to get the information you do. A couple other things. Let me give you a quick outline of who our guests are going to be for the next few weeks on Media Matters. 1 week from today, we've got another very timely show. Dan Schiller, another University of Illinois professor, will be on the air with us. And we're going to be talking about the meltdown in the telecoms industry in the United States and the world today. What caused it, what it means to have this collapse of one of the very largest industries in the world today. The following week, October 13th, our guest is going to be David Barsamian, the independent public radio broadcaster, the host of Alternative Nation, heard on WILL. And David Barsamian will be here to talk about his new book, The Decline and Fall of Public Broadcasting, talking about the trials and tribulations of nonprofit, noncommercial radio broadcasting and television broadcasting in the United States. October 20th, our guest, 3 weeks from today, is going to be my very dear friend, John Nichols, the national correspondent for The Nation magazine and a prominent author. And then finally, at the end of the month, is a very special show we've been planning for a long time here at Media Matters. We're going to have the three candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives from this district in the studio for a live show, Tim Johnson, Josh Hartke, and Carl Estabrook, to discuss the key issues concerning media policy that members of Congress face and will face in the next term and how the three of them regard them. That's 4 weeks from today, October 27th, just shortly before the election. So I think you'll want to stay tuned and hear that show. So that's our lineup for the next month here on Media Matters. But now let's get back to today's show. Again, our guest is U of I law professor Francis Boyle. We're talking about the prospective war in Iraq as the drums are beating. And we're talking about right now the war on terrorism that converted very quickly, as Professor Boyle's told us, from what was initially an act of war. Within a handful of nanoseconds, what was an act of war became, or excuse me, an act of terrorism became converted by the United States government as an act of war. And then the United States government, as of 9/12, what was the U.S. government trying to do? What was its strategy and policy with regard to responding to the 9/11 attacks?
Well, actually, Bob, as I point out in my book, the planning for the war against Afghanistan preceded September 11th. The war plan itself goes back to 1997. On or about September 11th, and we still don't know exactly what happened on September 11th. If you're following the hearings, we do know there's a cover-up going on. The Bush Jr. administration is desperately trying to keep whatever information from the public what happened on September 11th, why, who was behind this, why U.S. government intelligence agencies that did have this information did not stop it. But it is clear the United States government was already prepared to attack Afghanistan prior to September 11th. As of September 11th, there were two U.S. aircraft carrier task forces in the Persian Gulf. Second, as of September 11th, the British government had organized the largest armada since the Falkland Wars. It was in the Persian Gulf as well. There were 23,000 British troops on maneuver in Oman at that time. Likewise, as of September 11th, the Bright Star operation was going on in Egypt. There were 60,000 NATO troops on maneuver in Egypt. And as of September 11th, there were about 11,000 NATO troops that entered into Turkey. All this planning went back to 1997. You simply cannot put that amount of military force in one region all at one time unless the planning for it had gone back 3, 4, 5 years.
And was the concern starting in 1997 that they were just concerned about taking out al-Qaeda and these terrorists, doing a preemptive strike to get rid of terrorists so that we could sleep in peace in the United States? Is that the motivation behind this attack? Or the original plans, at least?
The other concern, of course, is the vast energy resources of Central Asia. As you know, the United States government under Clinton and continuing with Bush Jr. Had been sponsoring a pipeline through Afghanistan that would tap the natural energy resources of Central Asia that are second to only those of the Persian Gulf. And by the way, that project is now going forward. The president's special advisor for Afghanistan, who's now over there, was part of this effort. So I believe there was a dual agenda here.
Mm-hmm.
This was about getting access to that natural oil and gas. And if you had studied some of the strategic literature coming out, as you said, after the collapse of the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
People like Brzezinski, Weinberger, and others wrote openly in the pages of the Wall Street Journal that, by the way, I've subscribed to since 1978. I read it every day, try to, that access to Central Asia's natural resources, oil and gas, is a strategic national interest of the United States of America. So I believe there was a dual agenda here. And again, if you look at now the deployments of U.S. troops and forces and bases, we have bases all over Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, trying in Turkmenistan. So we're ringing this region with U.S. military bases and forces. I don't believe we're going to be going home anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're there to stay. Just as the first Bush senior war against Iraq was all about oil, basically I think the Bush junior war against Central Asia was about oil and natural gas. And indeed, the scenarios are very much the same. If you study the scenario for Iraq and Afghanistan, it seems very much the same, an oil grab.
Well, if 15 of the 19 known terrorists who destroyed, crashed those planes on September 11th were from Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia is sitting on this gold mine of oil, the biggest supply of oil, I think, in the world still, known reserves, why not invade Saudi Arabia on the same? Because then you get the best oil in the world and blame them, you know, say, hey, you guys were fostering these guys.
Right. And that assumes that 15 of the 19 were from Saudi Arabia. Again, the BBC just had a report saying several of these individuals are alive and victims of identity theft.
Mm.
So, again, we really don't know exactly what happened on mm-hmm. September 11th. I don't know. All I know is I follow the news media, the mainstream and alternative press. The government's account of what happened does not add up.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, I don't know. Now, finally, Bush Jr., kicking and screaming, has agreed to an independent investigation. He is trying to exclude access to intelligence sources for good reason. He doesn't want us to know really what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And we also have to pay attention to stacking this independent commission with people who will go along with a cover-up. I think the American people must demand from their members in Congress that we have an open public investigation here by a joint committee of Congress, like Watergate, with subpoena powers to be able to demand anyone from the FBI, CIA, NSA, DIA, military come in and explain what about these war preparations against Afghanistan? What did U.S. intelligence agencies know? Why did they not act on the information that they had? I do not have answers to these questions myself.
Now, if I understand you, then you're saying that our attack on Afghanistan last fall and this year, our war in Afghanistan, is not legal by international law.
No, it had never been. Bush Jr. tried to get, again, following the scenario of Bush Sr., and remember the overlap, many of the Bush Jr. people are Bush Sr. people. Cheney, Vice President, Bush Sr. Secretary of War. Condoleezza Rice, work for Bush Sr. Wolfowitz, work for Bush Sr. Mm-hmm. And Feith, work for Bush Sr. They tried to follow the Bush Sr. approach in getting authorization from the Security Council for a war against Afghanistan and failed. Indeed, they tried to get the Security Council to determine that this September 11th was an armed attack on the United States. That failed, too. The Security Council called this a terrorist attack, not an armed attack, invoking the right of self-defense, because the evidence simply was not there that the government of Afghanistan was behind this thing. If you read the Blair dossier, that's all we got. Bush Jr. said we were going to get a dossier, and we didn't. Mm-hmm. The U.S. government never produced a dossier. They left it to Tony Blair, who is derisively called Bush's pet poodle over in the British news media, to produce the dossier.
Okay, dossier,
and it was savaged.
Dossier, no dossier, international law, schminternational law. I mean, the fact of the matter, some people say, is we went in, we took out this terrible government in Afghanistan. Now women have legal rights. They're having a democracy there. Al-Qaeda is on the run. They're hiding in some caves. They aren't in a position to be killing innocent people. The world is a much better place as a result of this action by the U.S. government. True or false?
False. I mean, this is the propaganda we're getting from the mainstream U.S. news media about what's going on over there. If you follow the European press, third world press, alternative press, everyone knows Karzai is a CIA puppet. He was put in power. The control that they have, such as it is only over Kabul. There are repeated attacks on U.S. armed forces going on right now as we speak in Afghanistan. They have not told the truth about U.S. casualties in Afghanistan, and they certainly have lied about the amount and extent of civilian casualties in Afghanistan. A professor did do an independent study. He came up with about 4,000. So it's very much like the early stages of Vietnam, which I lived through, you lived through. They're lying. The mainstream news media is not getting the story out. We don't know exactly what's going on. The situation is very fragile. We could be U.S. government officials have admitted we're going to be in Afghanistan for a long time. Why? Number one, oil and natural gas of Central Asia. Number two, resistance by the people of Afghanistan. They fought the Soviets before us and the British before them. So my guess is we're in there we're going to be there for quite some time.
For the record, I want to make it clear that I was very young during the early stages of Vietnam, just so listeners don't think I look so young for my age. I look the You know, let's turn to Iraq now, because this really is the central issue before us today in late September, moving into October of 2002. you know, we've seen a strong shift from the Bush administration in the past 6 months or year away from Afghanistan, away from al-Qaeda. Certainly bin Laden has virtually disappeared, I think, from official pronouncements, except to compare him to Saddam Hussein, to Iraq. And there's been a strong case made by the U.S. government, not necessarily that it's strong in its merits, but a case that's being made strongly, powerfully, and incessantly, that the United States must invade Iraq and overthrow the government, replace it with another government. What is the U.S. government's argument? Put it in the best terms you can, then tell us what your assessment of that argument.
Well, we have to understand that the Bush Jr. plan against Iraq was devised before they came to power. This has now been reported quite extensively in the European press. Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense now, had drafted a plan for that purpose. He was a top Bush advisor during the campaign on foreign affairs. Rumsfeld himself has publicly admitted that immediately after the attack of September 11th, he ordered the Pentagon to plan to invade Iraq. What we've seen since then is simply whatever justification they can try to come up with to justify
They aren't going to put you on the PR staff at the Pentagon if that's the best you can do to explain why they're going to invade Iraq.
What I'm saying is they've come up with one lie after another after another. Last week it was reported in the London Times, here in the United States.
Owned by Rupert Murdoch.
Owned by Murdoch. But still the London Times reported that the State Department is launching a $200 million propaganda blitz against Iraq with whatever disinformation they can come up with to justify a war. So there are so many arguments. They move back and forth. First, it's preemptive attack. Then it's regime change. Then it's humanitarian intervention. The bottom line is, this is still about oil, as the first war was. Indeed, Jim Baker, Bush senior Secretary of Defense State, was very honest, and he publicly stated, look, this war is about oil. This one still is as well. Iraq controls 10% of the oil resources of the world. If the United States government goes in and occupies Iraq, not only will we control Iraqi oil, but we'll have a chokehold on all the oil and natural gas in the Persian Gulf and Central Asia. Again, you have to think strategically like Kissinger, Brzezinski, Huntington, and the Pentagon do. If you look at the string of U.S. military bases and deployments throughout the Persian Gulf and now Central Asia after Afghanistan, it's clear we're moving in for all of the oil and gas in that region of the world.
You know, Christopher Hitchens, a well-known commentator and writer, recently of The Nation magazine and for Vanity Fair, writes widely for the British press as well, he supports the invasion of Iraq. And his argument is that the United States basically set up Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, was his benefactor and main supporter, and he was evil then just as he is evil now, and that among his crimes was the terror inflicted against the Kurdish population in northern Iraq, and that we have an obligation then to go in, get rid of this truly horrendous regime, and install a democratic, humanitarian, cosmopolitan, multicultural society where human rights are respected. Isn't Saddam Hussein a lousy guy? Are we supposed to sit back while he tortures his population?
We have to understand we supported Saddam Hussein, starting with the so-called liberal Carter administration. Zbigniew Brzezinski, his national security advisor, the policy tilt toward Iraq. We armed, equipped, supplied, and financed Saddam Hussein. We even provided him weapons-specific biological agents, which in turn came back to haunt our own soldiers in the Gulf War.
Yeah, but Hitchens would say, Francis.
Well, let me finish. As he's using them against Iran. So we've done business with this guy. All the horrors he inflicted on his own people, the chemical weapons at Halabja and everything else, did not bother us at all. And indeed, we aided and abetted and assisted him. Now, as for Chris's other point, assuming we go into Iraq, again, it's all about oil. We could not care less about democracy in the Middle East. We have supported, a brutal dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. Bush Sr. said we were going to bring democracy to Kuwait. It's still a medieval sheikdom where women don't have the right to vote. And we have, 5,000 troops on there? We could change that tomorrow. So, again, this is the old humanitarian intervention argument. Again, it's illegal. It's not our business. Indeed, Colin Powell made these arguments at the Security Council, he's still making them about regime change. President Chirac of France correctly pointed out regime change violates the United Nations Charter. It's not our business to be changing regimes. Mm-hmm. It's clearly prohibited. But the bottom line is Saddam Hussein was our man for three administrations, Carter, Reagan, and Bush Sr. My belief is that what really needs to be done with Iraq is sit down and negotiate. That is clearly a requirement of the United Nations Charter. It is clearly a requirement of the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Sit down and negotiate over the disputes that do exist between Iraq, the United States, and the rest of the world. Arms inspections they've now agreed to. Lift this genocidal economic embargo that has been imposed upon them now since 1990. It has killed 1.5 million people in Iraq, 500,000 of whom are children. Lift the economic embargo. Keep an arms embargo.
Okay, let's say we do that. We follow this international law. What about the argument that while we're playing by the rule book, while we're playing by international law, Saddam Hussein will be developing all sorts of dastardly weapons that he will have given more time to develop nuclear warheads and chemical weapons that he will then be able to attack us and kill lots of people while we're being the do-gooders playing by the rule book, or that he will have more time to team up with al-Qaeda and the terrorist crowd to do more terrible terrorist acts around the world since he's dedicated to evil.
Well, of course, this is more Bush Jr. Propaganda that they're trying to make anything stick that they can. It's very interesting if you had a look at the accounts of the Blair dossier. Apparently, the British intelligence agencies have concluded and the IEA has concluded that Iraq does not have nuclear weapons and no prospect of getting them in the immediate future. And by the way, the weapons of mass destruction Iraq did have before the Gulf War, we gave them, the Germans gave them, the British helped give them. We helped give Iraq these weapons, figuring they were going to use them against Iran. So since the Gulf War, there's been a total cutoff. There's been an embargo. The IAEA put out a statement just the other day saying we have very good controls. But look, let's take the Cuban Missile Crisis under President Kennedy. I still remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. It first sparked my interest in international relations. Here you had Soviet intermediate-range ballistic missiles in Cuba that could target up to Washington, D.C. And as we later found out, they were armed. In the emergency meeting that President Kennedy had, he called a crisis management group called the Executive Committee, 25 members. In their first debates, a majority wanted to launch a preemptive attack on those missile sites. And during the course of this debate, President Kennedy sent a letter to his brother Bobby saying, I now know how Tojo felt when he was planning Pearl Harbor. Well, as you know, President Kennedy was a decorated veteran of World War II. He understood what was at stake. Were we going to act like Tojo and the Imperial German Japanese Empire? And the answer was no. There was no preemptive nuclear attack on Cuba. any attack. Kennedy went to the UN to get support. He went to the Organization of American States to get support. And he basically quarantined Cuba, which pretty much is what we've done to Iraq. Now, here you have, and fortunately, this approach avoided the Third World War. We now know authority had been given for the use of those missiles. If there had been a preemptive attack, we could have seen Washington, D.C. hit with these missiles. So here you have a very serious threat, only 90 miles away from the United States. President Kennedy handled this, and I've written about this in one or two of my books, mm-hmm. In what one would say in retrospect was a comparatively responsible manner. What we're seeing here with Bush Jr., who, by the way, dodged the draft in the Vietnam War, and almost all of his people did, Cheney, Wolfowitz, many of the rest of them, they never served in Vietnam. They don't know the first thing about war. What we're seeing here is completely irresponsible leadership. This is a war about oil and natural gas. And remember, the Bush family has enormous investments in oil. Cheney does too. They're going to make a killing here. Harkon, Energy, Enron, all the rest of them, Halliburton.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is University of Illinois Law Professor Francis Boyle. He's been talking to us about the legality and or illegality of the war on terrorism and the forthcoming war on Iraq and the regime change there. Your point is that there have been several different reasons, none of which really hold up very closely, for why we have to invade Iraq and take it over and install our own government, and that by all standards it is illegal by international law. A couple of questions jump out. One is, why now? Why September and October of 2002? Because if I understand the arguments being made by the Bush administration, none of them are time dated. I mean, the arguments could have been made in 1998 or 1992 or 1983 with the same validity and same fire. Nothing, to my knowledge, has changed in the last year, with the exception of the 9/11 attacks. And to my knowledge, there's still no evidence of any connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. In fact, they're enemies of each other, if I understand properly. So why now? Why is this an issue?
There's a very simple reason, because you have an election coming up in November where the Republicans want to regain control of both houses of Congress. Senator Byrd, the dean of the Senate, has already publicly made this point, that this is all about distraction from the domestic scandals that had engulfed the Bush administration, including Harkin, Energy, Halliburton, Enron, some of which involve the president and the vice president themselves. And they were quickly falling in the polls. So now that the campaign season has started, they've been very effective in putting all that behind them and trying to focus on the issue of war and peace and drown out the points that the Democrats were making about domestic agenda issues. I want to make clear, I'm a political independent. Mm-hmm. I always have been. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. And indeed, I've given advice, counsel, and assistance to members of Congress, both the House and the Senate, of both parties. I note Ralph Nader has recently made this exact same point. This crisis is all about the Bush Jr. people trying to win control of the Senate and keep control of the House. So, and yesterday, Senator Daschle pretty much made the same point.
This is Wednesday, because we're taping on Thursday.
Right. Made the same point.
So the wag the dog scenario after the film that was made a few years ago. Did you ever see that movie?
No, I never did. I have three boys, and I only, you know, the last movie I got to see with them was the last Star Wars movie or something. That's the type of thing, unfortunately, I have to see these days.
Well, okay. Well, Wag the Dog is a well-known movie from about 4 years ago with Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman, in which the president, to avoid a sex scandal, they create a bogus, fictitious war in Albania to sort of distract the population. And That seems to be the exact scenario we're looking at here by that by what you're talking about and what Robert Byrd, the Senate, former Senate Majority Leader, had spoken about. Well, the Wall Street Journal, Wednesday of this week, 4 days before we've gone on air, published a column by two attorneys who worked for both the Reagan and Bush the First administrations, arguing that an invasion of Iraq and a regime change would, in fact, be legal. Their argument was that even though the Constitution says we're supposed to abide by treaties, and the UN Charter is indeed a treaty, so on the surface it looks like that would violate the Constitution to invade Iraq. And I couldn't really understand the argument, frankly.
Right.
Through some sort of mumbo jumbo, we can ignore that if we want to invade Iraq.
That's the argument.
Is there a credible legal argument in your view as a legal scholar?
Well, the United Nations Charter is a treaty, and under the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. Likewise, the Kellogg-Briand Pact prohibiting aggressive warfare is a treaty. Iraq is a party as well. Indeed, we prosecuted Nazis at Nuremberg for violating the Kellogg-Briand Pact and executed some of them. If Congress were to authorize war, irrespective of our obligations under the United Nations Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact, that is not going to excuse any violations of international law. It was well established at the Nuremberg Tribunal that a state and an individual cannot plead domestic law to excuse violations of international law. For example, in the Nazi persecution of the Jews, one of the arguments made was, well, this didn't violate Nazi law.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews, as you know, had been denationalized and basically outlawed in the sense that they had no legal protection, no legal personality. And the Nuremberg Tribunal dealt with that by responding, you know, murder is murder. You cannot plead domestic law to excuse violations of international law. So maybe Bush Jr. might get authority for war from Congress. I do not know. As you know, they're debating about this today as we speak, what this resolution might say. I will have to take a look at the resolution. But that certainly would not excuse any violation of the UN Charter, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, the Geneva Conventions.
Francis Boyle, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters. We didn't get much of a chance to talk about the media, but we got a lot of chance to talk about what's going on in Iraq and help our listeners try to wade through the legal issues and what they're going to be hearing in the media and judge for themselves. Thanks again for being our guest, and I want to thank you all for joining me, Bob McChesney, Media Matters, and I will see you 1 week from today with Dan Schiller.